Achtung, Punkrock-Freunde, this is the Blurred Crusade, live on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Hello to you all, welcome to Viewpoints, where local news meets a national audience. On today's lineup, the historic Bellevue House located in Kingston, Ontario, is reopening its doors to the public after being closed for 6 years.
It was a great opportunity to rethink what we presented in the house, how to present it, and what really needed. There's a lot of Indigenous stories that need to be shared here at Bellevue House, but there's a lot of other stories too. This is a Canadian story.
The town of Stanstead seeks a new future for the historic Del Monte Hotel property.
To be honest, the building is falling apart and it's condemned. We have it boarded up with plywood and stuff so people don't get hurt. There's walls that are falling down. The ceiling is collapsed. We're just hoping that something comes back in that area. And
the Toronto Japanese Film Festival enters its 13th year, presenting more international premieres.
It's an extension of what we do at the Japanese Canadian Cultural Center, which is to introduce Japanese culture to all Canadians.
And we'll be visiting a human rights exhibit that has been touring in different locations in the province of BC.
We want to do justice to the thousands of stories we heard of people who shared their experiences with hate. And art has a real connection to how we feel in the world. It can change our experience of a moment.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Welcome again. Thanks for being with us. My name is Boris Chassaigne. We first take a trip down memory lane to explore the historic Bellevue House located in Kingston that has just reopened its doors to the public after being closed for 6 years. The former residence of Canada's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, has reopened on May 18th. The work done leading up to the reopening included structural repairs and also strategic changes to their exhibits and programming after a transformative review of site management plans released in 2023. Visitors were able to enjoy the site for free on opening day. In Kingston, Ontario, Christina Laurie has that story for us.
The former residence of Canada's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, is reopening its doors to the public. This reopening represents the start of a new era for the National Historic Site, aiming to address Sir John A. Macdonald's legacy from multiple points of view. Work done leading up to this reopening did not just include structural repairs, but also considerable changes to their exhibits and programming after a transformative review of the site management plans released last summer. In a release regarding the opening, Parks Canada states, quote, "The new experience represents a new way of sharing history at Parks Canada's heritage places, one which includes diverse voices, presents multiple perspectives, and inspires conversations about Canada's past, present, and future." I sat down with Hugh Ostrom, National Historic Site Superintendent for Parks Canada, to discuss the reopening of Bellevue House. I was wondering if you'd just like to introduce yourself for our listeners.
Yeah, I'm Hugh Ostrom. I'm the National Historic Site Superintendent for Parks Canada, and that means I'm responsible for the historic sites in the Central Ontario region.
Awesome stuff, yeah. And the Bellevue House is reopening this weekend. I was wondering if you could give some background. How long has the site been closed for restoration?
Well, Bellevue House, the property has been open to the public for a number of years now, interpreting on the grounds. But this is the first year that the historic house will be open to the public since 2018. Mm-hmm. So it's been a long time that we've been going through this restoration project, but it was a lot more than just a restoration because, you know, what started as a roof project and identified some structural risks that then, you know, required us to remove floorboards to resolve. So why not redo the electrical when we're there? And so the scope of work did change over time, and obviously the house had to be emptied to do that work. So when all the artifacts and furniture and such were removed from the house, it was a great opportunity to rethink what we presented in the house, how to present it, and what really needed to go back into the site.
Yeah, you kind of got into all that structural work that was done, but there was also just recently a review that resulted in a lot of strategic changes to the exhibits and programming. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to that and how that's going to come into play when the house reopens.
As you just mentioned, we've completely redone the visitor experience side of the site as well. And so when all those artifacts and things were taken out of the house, we took a moment to think about what needed to go back in the site. What stories should be told? How should they be told? And we started by reaching out to an Indigenous consultant here in Kingston, recognizing that there's a lot of perspectives that we were not sharing previously at Bellevue House, and that, you know, we needed to find a way to express those and make space and share that authority. So through our consultant, we were able to form an Indigenous working circle with a community of Indigenous people in Kingston, and really at their advice and full credit to them for their help, they really said that, you know, there's a lot of Indigenous stories that need to be shared here at Bellevue House, but there's a lot of other stories too. This is a Canadian story, and it's all walks of life in Canada, and we need to make a larger advisory committee to include those other voices as well. So, you know, from that Indigenous working circle, we then expanded into a community advisory committee that included, you know, some of the urban Indigenous community we'd started working with, the First Nations near us, the Mohawk of Agwasosne and Tiantanaga. We worked with, you know, Tourism Kingston, historians, you know, other racialized communities in Kingston. And it was a really great experience for us to learn all these other perspectives of how McDonald's and his government's policies have affected other communities as well over time. So there's place for all of those stories in the house now.
Absolutely. That's some big changes there. That's a really exciting new era we're kind of walking into here.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the crew that's at the site now, obviously, it's been closed since 2018. And so for most of them, and in fact, I think all of them, this will be the first time that we'll be able to interpret the interior of the house to the public. And it's a really exciting opportunity.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's an official reopening on Saturday. And then from then on, will folks be able to visit?
Yeah, so the site opens at 10 o'clock on Saturday, May 18th. We'll have a reopening event at 10:30. And the site will be available, free admission on the Saturday. And then normal operations will resume on the Sunday. So it'll be, you know, a fee for tours and entry. And we'll be able to offer more programs as well, because I anticipate that with a free day, you often get a good number of people out, which is fantastic. But for people that want to take more time and have less of a crowd, the site will be open from Thursday to Monday. So that means it's closed Tuesdays and Wednesdays until July. And then it's open 7 days a week throughout the summer.
Perfect. Awesome stuff. Well, thanks so much for sitting down with me this afternoon and getting into this exciting opening.
No, thanks very much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. And we are certainly excited to see the public there and see how they experience the new site as well.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
To Quebec now, where the town of Stansted is hoping to find a new buyer for another architectural jewel, the Del Monte Hotel, not Del Monte. The USA-Canada border town of Stansted is seeking a committed buyer to rejuvenate or bring new life into the once vibrant hotel, once a symbol of the economic vitality of the region. Despite its rich heritage, the hotel has remained abandoned for about 7 years due to unpaid taxes, prompting the town's intervention, and it's kind of falling apart. While no official project deposits have been made, Mayor Jody Stone says there is significant interest from potential developers, with the town offering flexibility in the sales process and the end result. Stansted Mayor Jody Stone recounts its storied history, tracing back to the 1920s when the Del Monte family took ownership, and the challenges the town faces in making a decision about what to do with the building and land. Derek Bullard in Sherbrooke, Quebec.
Yeah, the hotel was, it's dated back in the 20s. The Del Monte family from Granby took over the hotel. At the time, the hotel was called the Rock Island House. Mm-hmm. But in the early 30s, the hotel was badly damaged in a fire. And then a few years later, the Del Monte family rebuilt the hotel and named it the Del Monte Hotel. So that's where the beginning of the hotel started.
Our guest, Mr. Stone, explains that this grand old hotel has been left to languish in abandonment for at least 7 long years, a stark contrast to its heyday. But what led up to this moment? What catalyzed the town's decision to intervene? Well, it turns out it all began with a financial hiccup. When the owners failed to pay their taxes, Stansted stepped in, allowing them to bid on the property.
It's been abandoned for at least, completely abandoned, probably the last 7 years. Before that, it wasn't used very much. The thing that instigated this was the owners of the building didn't pay their taxes. So the town has a policy in place that we bid on the properties at the taxes that are owed. So in this case, if the taxes were $500 that were owed, well, the town would bid up to $500. And if another bidder come in, they could bid above that and they would most likely win the bid. So in this case, we bid the amount that was owed for taxes, which was somewhere around the $80,000 range. And there was no other bidders. So it was like it put us in this situation where we don't really want to take over this building, but at the same time, now we're in control of what can happen in the building. Especially being in the heart of the Rock Island area, the downtown.
The mayor goes on to highlight that there are structural challenges facing the aging building, which prompted the town to make public its search for a buyer.
Right. Well, initially, we had an engineer come in and look at the structure because there's many things to consider. One is the building is against the 'cause there's a hill there and the building is kind of touching the hill. So if we tear the building down, what would that have for an impact on the road? Also, is it the building structurally sound? Because the roof has been leaking for a very long time. We wanted to know what could be done. So the engineer went in, did a report, and said, well, the structure is sound, which means the foundation. And because the building is built out of steel, the steel frame is still good. But anything that's wood or any other material needs to be replaced. So basically, it's a gut, complete gut, and could be rebuilt. So what happened is that we've gotten a few people of interest, and that's why we've gone out for put this public so that people could come and show their interest in the building.
With its dilapidated state and storied past, questions arise about its significance and the potential for preservation. The mayor provides a candid perspective, acknowledging the building's ties to community memories while underscoring the practicalities of its current condition.
Yeah, well, that's it. I believe there's the building or the thought of the building has historical significance. People associate the Del Monte with lots of activities or things they've done in the past. But I don't think the building itself is what people remember. They remember what they did inside the building. I think the people love to see something back in that space, but I don't think the building itself is of importance. But the thought of what was there at the time.
Our guest, the mayor of Stansted, sheds light on the town's stance regarding the former Del Monte Hotel. And despite its historical significance, it seems preservation isn't a priority.
No, because it's not a site building. So no, there's nothing that needs to be preserved. And if anything, the only thing preserved would be the foundation. There's no real restrictions from the town for that building. To be honest, the building is falling apart and it's... Okay. And, you know, it's condemned. We have it boarded up with plywood and stuff so people don't get hurt. There's walls that are falling down. The ceiling is collapsed. So, no, there's nothing to preserve. We're just hoping that something comes back in that area.
So now as the town embarks on this journey of revitalization, one question looms large. What kind of project will take shape in the heart of Stansted?
Yeah, well, we'd love to see as much as possible some new housing. There's really a lack of housing in Stansted. So maybe a possibility of commercial at the bottom, housing at the top. But we've not put any restrictions when we went out for bids. We're really letting the developers propose their ideas, something we just hadn't thought of, that would be interesting. So, we're very open to that, and we're trying to put the fewest restrictions possible on that building. Of course, if somebody does take on the project, it means they have to complete the project. So there's no, oh, well, I'm going to buy it and do it in 10 years. No. It needs to be, there needs to be a good timeline, and it needs to be, they need to have financial backing and et cetera.
The mayor goes on to reveal to us that while there haven't been any official deposits yet, there's been considerable interest from potential developers. With the deadline looming, the town remains hopeful that these interested parties will step up and commit to the project.
We haven't had any official deposits. They have until the end of the month. But we did have people beforehand with interest. So we're hoping that these people that were interested actually deposit a project. And the reason we went this route was to allow the town to have certain flexibility. Which means that normally when you sell a property, the town has to sell it for the current value. And the building still currently has a value of $268,000, which is extremely high for a building that's collapsing. So by going this route, we're able to considerably lower that. Depending on the project, who knows, the town might be willing to even, give the building so there's a lot of openness from the town council to making sure that this project, something happens in this location.
Thank you once again to Mr. Jody Stone, mayor of Stansted.
We also learned from Derek Bullard in Sherbrooke, Quebec, that plans are also underway to revitalize Stansted's historic Border Theatre, a cultural landmark with roots dating back to 1912.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
BC's Office of the Human Rights Commissioner is hosting a particular kind of touring exhibit that allows visitors to step inside the stories of people impacted by hate in the province. The project follows an inquiry conducted by the office entitled From Hate to Hope, Inquiry into Hate in the COVID-19 Pandemic. The inquiry found an increase in hate towards minorities and certain groups of people during the pandemic. After the published report, the office unveiled 4 murals meant to bring people together to combat hate. The murals were placed in Vancouver, Fort St. John, Karemeos, and Nanaimo. Commissioner Kasari Govender spoke to journalist Lauren McKenzie about the inquiry and what she hopes the exhibit can do for communities.
The Nanaimo mural is located at the Nanaimo Aquatic Center and was made in partnership with Humanity in Art and Youth from the Rise Bridge Summer Youth Program. Now the office is hosting an immersive exhibit that merges the voices heard during the inquiry and the murals created. This touring exhibit will allow participants to reflect on their own experiences and to take action to address hate in their communities. The exhibit has toured around the province in the last month, stopping off in Vancouver, Kelowna, and Fort St. John. Commissioner Kasari Govender says they heard from thousands of people across the province about the hate they faced and how their communities responded to it.
So hate is definitely not something that's isolated to one community in the province by any means. When we look to do murals and then to do an art exhibit to really move the conversation from this dense report to a much broader, more accessible conversation through the medium of public art.
For the murals, she says they chose communities to receive them, not because hate was a particular problem there, but because they represented the diversity of British Columbia.
Namibia. So small communities, larger communities, communities in different regions across the province. And again, the message really being that this is something, unfortunately, that unites us, but also that we can be united in our responses and our move from hate to hope, hence the name of the inquiry, as well as the murals and exhibit itself.
She says the murals and the exhibit go along with the commitment the office has to not only collect reports, but to start conversations around it.
So we really wanted to ensure, we have a commitment as an office to ensure that we have no more dusty reports, no more reports just sitting on a chair gathering dust. We want to do justice to the thousands of stories we heard of people who shared their experiences with hate. And we wanted to ensure that those that the report really didn't just get stagnant, but in fact kept a life and conversation and community going.
She says public art is a great way to showcase the findings and the voices behind the report.
You know, as a lawyer, I'd like to think convincing arguments will hold the day. But in fact, what really is persuasive for people is how they feel about something. And art has a real connection to how we feel in the world. It can change our experience of a moment. It can communicate an emotional connection. It can, in public art, have the context of helping us feel like we belong somewhere if we see ourselves represented or feel a connection to art. So art plays a really unique role in social movements and in this one in particular.
She says the overall message of the report and the exhibit is that there's a rise in hate and it's something that cannot be ignored.
So really to help people understand what's happening out there and then to move us from that place of hate towards a more hopeful state, to understand that nothing will happen on this if unless we hope for a better future. And it's that trajectory of understanding where we are, understanding the impact of hate in our communities, but to also move towards action that I'm hoping we can continue to do with not only the inquiry, but also the public art through the murals and through the exhibit, and then through our partnership with public libraries across the province.
This is Laura McKenzie.
The exhibit has left Nanaimo on May 17 and is now en route to Vancouver, where it will open on May 23rd. This year's Toronto Japanese Film Festival is set to open in a few weeks. All but three of the 24 movies being screened are premieres for international or Canadian audiences. The festival runs from June 6 to 20. The film festival, launched in 2011 by the Japanese Canadian Cultural Center, has over the years gained recognition from Japanese directors. James Herron, the executive director of the Japanese Canadian Cultural Center, watched over 80 movies and will now showcase 24 of them. Here's a short excerpt from Owen Thompson's conversations here.
This is our 13th year, and it's it brings a lot of contemporary Japanese films for, you know, in many cases, international or North American or Canadian premieres. They're all subtitled so that they're accessible to not just the Japanese community, but to all Canadians. Really, it's an extension of what we do at the Japanese Canadian Cultural Center, which is to introduce Japanese culture to all Canadians.
The film festival is comprised of around 24, 25 Japanese movies. So what goes into, I guess, going through and setting up these 24, 25 movies?
You know, first of all, I guess, I kind of have a kind of a programming philosophy, I guess, which is really to reflect really the broad spectrum of the Japanese film industry. So not just art films or not just genre films, but to make sure that we sort of get things across the board from anime to drama to comedies and, you know, historical samurai epics, documentaries and indies. So, you know, things show the breadth and the depth of the industry. And we also make a point of looking for films whenever we can that refer to specific aspects of Japanese culture. So, for example, this lineup has a film called Taka no Tofu. So it's about a traditional tofu maker. So, again, that speaks directly to some of Japan's more traditional culture, as does with a movie called Tsugaru Lacquer Girl, which is about the lacquer industry. So, and last year we did some that were specific to Japanese bathhouses and to Japanese calligraphy, et cetera. So we can find good films that touch on those sorts of themes. We definitely try to bring those into the festival as well. There was one really interesting one, and it's not even something that not even a premiere. I think it played at Hot Docs, but it's a film called Mr. Jimmy, and it's a documentary about a fellow named Akio Sakurai. He was a Japanese salesperson, salaryman, with a deep love of Jimmy Page, almost obsessive about Jimmy Page. And this fellow is an excellent guitar player. He used to have his own sort of a kind of a cover type band, and he'd play in clubs in Roppongi, etc. And he was well known for whether his clothing, his appearance, and his ability to play so perfectly that he could play, if you said to him, play the Thursday night show in Madison Square Garden in 1976, he could play that concert. He could play that version of the concert versus the night before. And so he got this reputation. And then one day, Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin came into the club and was bowled over by what he saw. And that sort of gave him the push to put his life aside and to start playing this professionally. So now, for example, there's John Bonham, the Led Zeppelin's drummer, his son, Jason Bonham, performs internationally with Mr. Jimmy as his guitarist. So anyway, there's a documentary about him, but also he's going to be coming and actually performing in our Kobashi Hall this summer. So this will be the summer of Mr. Jimmy at the Cultural Center, the Japanese Jimmy Page. And it's really interesting. One thing that I find really interesting is that it manages to take, you know, the sort of the passion of rock and roll, but the really meticulousness of Japanese craftsmanship, you know, and sort of that Shokuninkan type of idea of, you know, just redoing it and redoing something and making it better and better each time. So he manages to take those two extremes and blend them together to create something quite special. So that's something I didn't see coming, but I think it'll be a really nice fit for the festival.
And that's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists, Christina Laurie, Derek Bullard, Owen Thompson, and Lauren McKenzie. Our national editors were Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the collaboration of your local radio station. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, goodbye.
Tune to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.